Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Sussex Cricket Museum. I think we're virtually at the beginning of the cricket season now, and we're sitting in a clubhouse as part of our village cricket series. We'll come to where we are in a moment, but just going back a little bit, our last podcast we had a guest, and that guest promised to give a piece of his cricket kit to the museum. Now, that piece of kit has been given to the museum, and I can report that it is a House of Commons cricket tie. I'm not going to reveal who the guest was, but if you listen to our podcast, you'll find out. And this tie now is in the museum, and you can no doubt come and see it. But today, we're in West Sussex. So we've been over to Newick in East Sussex. We've been to Henfield in West Sussex. Most of the villages that we go to, I think the cricket is played on a green. But today, the village we're at, they play on the common. So the village we're at is indeed Linfield in West Sussex, and we've got two guests, Malcolm. Hello, Malcolm.
Hi, everyone.
And Colin.
Hi, hello.
And our old friend, Roger.
Hello there, Keith.
So we've been talking to the guys here, and we're in the pavilion looking out across the ground, which is quite boggy still, isn't it? I think we're... When do you start your games?
We're meant to start a week on Saturday, the 20th, and as it stands at the moment, the square is perfectly playable, but the outfield is a bit of a challenge, like many clubs around the area at the moment. Right. But hopefully we'll get a game in.
Lovely.
OK. The pavilion, much like the pavilion in Henfield, has got bits of memorabilia on the walls around the outside of the pavilion. And there's a bar which is shut at the moment. And as at Henfield, I've noticed there is one of these. The bell for teas, is it? Or
normally teas, occasionally lunches.
It's the normally the start of the second innings, in between innings.
Yeah. So, lovely. OK. Now, just to put this into context, the reason we're here is that Colin and Malcolm approached the museum and wanted to talk about producing a book about the history of Linfield Cricket Club. And I think you've got quite a bit of stuff around the place, haven't you guys?
Very much so. There's four of us at the moment, myself, Colin, Ian Jackson and Mike Newcomb. We started at the club in the probably mid-70s. And we were very part of the village family, and we felt we wanted to give something back to the part of our enjoyment of cricket. And we got together and said, right, let's try and work something through. Originally, our scorer, John Pollard, who was associated with the club for many, many years, got a lot of archive information. Unfortunately, he's passed away, and we felt it only right that we should try and finish that project off. So we started the book, and we're getting a lot of archive information, which is fantastic. And Colin, in his wisdom, is going to try and break it up a little bit more information for us to actually work up a proper readable version of a book. So we've got a lot of work to carry out, but we're very keen and very passionate to do the right thing about the village as a whole.
And Linfield's very much a community cricket club, isn't it? You've got a booming youth team and youth 11.
Yes, we participate in the All-Stars 5-year-old to 9-year-old age groups. Last year we had the largest participants in Sussex, which was fantastic. That in its own right creates a lot of actually administration and needs lots of volunteers to help us. But we run age groups right through to under 16s, and we've got four Saturday sides and a Sunday side and two midweek teams, as well as a ladies side. So we're quite a big side, a club as a whole. A lot of administration work involved, but it's something we are very passionate about. We want to give something back, as I said earlier on, to the village, and we enjoy our cricket, and that's what it's all about. Mm. It's not all about necessarily winning. Yes, it's nice to win, but it's nice to meet new friends, meet new colleagues from other clubs as well.
And Colin, you're very much involved with this business of producing the book on the history. Whereabouts is that at the moment? How far away are you?
I think the phrase is it's at the development stage, is to put it nicely. We found vastly more probably archive material than we probably expected. We kicked this process off really 2 years ago. It involves scouring attics, people's cupboards, and a lot of stuff came to us that we hardly realised we had as well, that was tucked away in various places. The challenge is both assembling the material. We've had another sifting session to sort of work out where we had overlaps, but to break it down into different periods of history from the mid-18th century on to the present day. And to create a history of, it's not just Linfield Cricket Club, but cricket in Linfield itself within the village. Because one of the things we found out is quite quickly is how sort of the cricket developed around the village, not purely on the common. But there's a story to be told there. But from now on, it's really about looking at the different periods, seeing what's really interesting. We've got a pretty clear view already of sort of how the book would run. The challenge now is writing it and putting it all together. We're pretty well off, I think, in terms of photographs, which is a blessing. The challenge now is actually doing it, really.
Well, good luck with that, guys. I suppose we ought to just put Linfield in context of where we are in Sussex for our listeners. We pick up listeners all over the world on these podcasts. So Linfield is very much, although it's technically in West Sussex, it's very much in the middle of Sussex. It's about a couple of miles north of Haywards Heath and about 15 miles north of Brighton. It has a beautiful high street with a pond, and it's generally a lovely area, isn't it? So, it's worth coming to Linfield, and I'm sure you have the pavilion open on cricket days for people to come and see?
Yep, certainly. The games normally start at 12:30, and an hour before then the pavilion's open, and it carries on to most evenings up to 2100 hours, so it's open all day on Saturday and also on Sundays as well, as well as occasional midweek games. So, yeah, it's fully operational, and there's lots to see in the pavilion with archive information and lovely old pictures, and you're always receiving a nice warm welcome.
Yeah. Lovely. We'll have a wander around the pavilion in a minute. You've got some very interesting bits and pieces here, but let's just go back to start with, to the very beginning of village cricket in Linfield. And I think there's a debate going on, isn't there, about the date that you started. I've got a figure here of 1747, but I think you're going to tell us, Colin, that that's not quite right.
Not quite right. I think probably, as I put it, there's a mystery to our history, is the way I've kind of viewed it. People had settled on this probably slightly arbitrary date of 1747 some years ago. It may have been as part of the club being revitalised post-war and having a good anniversary to hook it onto. We believe, and there does seem now to be some evidence that it's actually was possibly another 10 years or so before that. But that is the glory of this, in that a lot of the history is pretty murky. But if we can pin it down as well as we can, that would be perhaps one of the key things to do within the book.
Right. Let's bring Roger in here, because you're the cricket historian, Roger. 1733, I've got a date, as well as 1747. And William Gage?
Yes, 1733 is a record of when there was cricket played at Linfield, authenticated. But we have to be very careful about extending the whole lifetime of a club back to the earliest reference, because you will find when you research that clubs come and they go, and they're sometimes moribund for many, many years and then get revived, but they claim the earliest possible date to make them sound like they're part of antiquity. However, the message with the book, or the proposed book, is that it's a history of cricket at Linfield, maybe covering different clubs, it doesn't matter, generally played on the common, and it's one of the cricketing centres of the whole county, with an excellent pedigree, and it includes more modern times when Sussex Second Eleven played competitive matches here, and the Reverend David Shepherd put in an appearance, and I'm sure the lads here will have so many more other anecdotes and personalities from cricket history to bring out in the book. So I would like maybe for the Sussex Cricket Museum to consider publishing it, if that's what the Linfield people would like, because I see the role of the Sussex Cricket Museum as extending around the county, helping clubs such as Linfield with historical projects. And to that end, I'm also helping people at Storrington and at Ditchling with cricketing histories. And I think if they're done reasonably well, they will make a huge contribution to the history of Sussex cricket.
Thank you, Roger. Now, those early matches, they weren't just about cricket, were they? I mean, we've got an election probably coming up this year. Yes. So when William Gage was involved and the Duke of Newcastle, what was going on then, Roger, with cricket in this area?
Well, yes, a lot of early cricket references coincide with meetings around elections, and people like Gage or like Newcastle, who owned property or land in Linfield, would do their very best to seduce the villagers to get their votes, and woe betide those who didn't vote for the respective landowner. They could find themselves out of a tied house or a job, but very often a cricket match was included in the package. I think there are victory matches. The earliest reference to Cookfield cricket involves an election, and probably Burrell, one of the landowners there. So elections and cricket do very often go hand in hand.
So if you didn't vote the right way, you lost your house and your job.
You could do... No, yes, that's perfectly true. Even with more recent times, I know of places in Surrey where the Lord of the Manor handed out voting cards with the X already printed against his own name, so you daren't risk voting for the other chap at your peril.
And just coming a little bit nearer current times, 1802, there was a game against Brighton, I think, when there was a purse of 500 guineas at stake. And I think this was the only match where Linfield gave up, is the words that I heard. I don't know if anybody wants to comment on this game. Obviously, nobody was around then, but Colin's got something.
We were nearly around then. It feels like it. No, I've heard of the game. I haven't seen it, the details, but I've certainly heard. There's been the odd concession, I think, over time, but I don't think gave up has appeared on too many scorecards.
Yeah. Apparently, the scores. Brighton scored 146 and 117 for 5. Linfield, 59. And this was the first and only time in its history, I'm told, that Linfield gave up the ghost altogether. So, and of course, Lord Sheffield has been involved. Now, we've mentioned Lord Sheffield when we were at Newick. And Roger, you can tell us a bit more about Lord Sheffield's involvement with Newick and surrounding clubs.
Yes, indeed, Keith. Lord Sheffield was perhaps the greatest benefactor of Sussex cricket, maybe even including Sven Kamer of more recent times. But Lord Sheffield, whose dates are 1832 to 1909, not only had his own cricket ground at Sheffield Park, beautifully restored by the National Trust in recent years, he also patronised a lot of the local cricket clubs, including Linfield, and many of them in mid-Sussex. Lord Sheffield had property in New Haven, so he was a patron of New Haven Cricket Club, and he just couldn't do enough for furthering cricket. Mind you, he liked to win, and he built up a very strong side at Sheffield Park, including several very good professionals, and they would take on a lot of the village clubs, hugely entertaining. The band would be playing, the rhododendrons would no doubt be out, but the cricket was so one-sided, and Lord Sheffield's side would very often amass something like 500 and bowl little Newick out or little Barkham out for about 45 and put them in again. And this would happen time and again. But that was how a Lord would see his duty as being a strong landowner, cricket lover, showing his strength. But we forgive him that because of his involvement and his very generous purse to a lot of the local clubs, including Linfield.
Lovely. Okay. Now, just jumping on about 100 years, Linfield and Haywards Heath played together at one time, and I think Skeynes Hill. So,
yeah, I'm not sure about Skeynes Hill. I know that Linfield and Haywards Heath joined forces.
Right.
It was at a time when I think Haywards Heath was struggling financially, and they joined Linfield. And that lasted for a number of years before Houseyth got back on its feet again, which was great, and they then created their own club. But yeah, as things have gone on, we've always had a local rivalry between the clubs, as we do with Cookfield and Burgess Hill, which is great, and it's done in the right way.
Right.
But yeah, we're part of the tradition with Houseyth, and that continued for a number of years. And we celebrated a few years ago their centenary, 100 years, and we had a special game with Houseyth down at the Rec to support that game. Yeah.
Now, just looking out of the pavilion here at the square, I understand that it was moved. Originally, it was further north than it is at the present time.
That's what we believe. We're still trying to find the actual detail, but exactly where it was, but we believe it was further down, and it got moved further up here towards the current position. But it's now on quite a strong slope, shall we say, whereas before it was quite flat. Not sure why they moved it, whether it's more boggy where it was before. But obviously the Common's a large area, and I think perhaps they felt it was nearer to the road and more people would watch the games. But that's the sort of area we're trying to find a bit more information about why it was moved.
And I think Roger may be able to help us here. A chap called George Brown of Ardingly and Sussex hit a famous six into the Lewis Road. Are you aware of that, Roger?
I am aware. I think it was George Brown.
George
Brown.
Yes.
Yeah. It was a famous Ardingly College amateur, a huge hitter. He would have gone down very well with the Bazball era. And I think he is recorded also as getting one of the very rare centuries to be scored at Linfield, maybe the first for 20 years when he got one in the 1890s. Mm. But I'm not aware of the hit into the Lewis Road, but it wouldn't surprise me. Mm. He certainly had the capacity to do just that. Mm.
Mm. So just moving up to the modern era, 2014, I understand, was a big year when you got promoted into the second tier of the County League.
That's right. There's been a number of years before that where the County League, the Mid-Sussex League, East Sussex League and the Invitation League were trying to amalgamate into one structure. Thankfully, it did happen. I think there's a lot of sort of pushing from those clubs to make it happen, to have a proper pyramid system. We were fortunate enough to be allocated into the Division 2, and we've done well. But as with all clubs, you have your ups and you have your downs. But it's the right structure for Sussex. And it's a good thing, and it's going from strength to strength. It's the largest league now in the world, with a number of clubs and divisions. So it's doing very, very well. Without league cricket, we as a club would not have survived. Interestingly, when you look back at league cricket when it first started in 97, for us, there was a lot of, should we say, 50-50 people on views on whether we should actually go to league cricket. It wasn't deemed to be the right thing. The youngsters wanted it. The older ones weren't so keen.
Yes.
We went with the league cricket, and it was the best thing we ever did. If we hadn't gone with that, the club probably would have been in a struggle to continue. But because we had a good set of youngsters, that took the club through for the next 20, 30 years.
Right.
So league cricket, for all its faults, is really a good thing overall because it's helped the club progress accordingly.
Okay. And as with any village, you've got some people who have been with Linfield for many years. Two that I came up with, Brian and Gwen Newcomb. And I think Brian played 46 years for Newick. They were local people and they'd been around and done a lot for the club.
Yep, very much so. And Mike, his son, and his grandson, other sons, they've all got involved with the club as well. Brian was involved with the Linfield Football Club as well. So, and Gwen still comes to watch the games as well on match days and during cricket week. So they are a family club, part of the club. The Sears were another group of people who were heavily involved, the Wickhams. So it's a club that's got a lot of tradition with families, and that's a real strength for the club going forward. It's probably not as strong as it used to be in that sense, but it's something that the club's very proud of and something we never forget. So, family traditions are very important. So people like Gwyn and Brian, you can be very important, yes.
And there's also your scorer, John Pollard.
John was a legend. He was involved with the club for 50-odd years. Unfortunately, he died 4 or 5 years ago. But he would tell you many, many stories where he used to walk to places like Rottingdean, cycle to places as well. Everybody in Sussex knew of him. He had the most beautiful handwriting. Mm. He did all the scores by hand, put all the anecdotes, notes about the games. Very, very conscientious. But he started, as far as we're concerned, the history of the club. He went to all the local libraries, getting all the information, which we weren't really aware of at the time. He was very passionate about it. And we've got the information from John. We asked him to do a book for us. Mm-hmm. But John was so keen to do the right thing, he kept writing and writing lots of notes. But we've got the information. But without John's history and knowledge, we would have probably struggled with a lot of the information getting it to where we are today. Mm-hmm. But John, without question, was a fantastic character. Mm-hmm. Everybody loved the guy. Mm-hmm. And it was a sad day when he passed away, but his memory is still with us. Mm-hmm. We've mentioned that the score box we got, that's under his name now as well. So, but John is part of Linfield and always will be.
I understand he used to cycle to some games.
He used to cycle. He could tell you many stories. Yes. Where there was one story where he was cycling home with some guys and he heard this police car coming behind, and they threw the bike over the fence, and all the guys rushed because there had been a few drinks late at night, and they all sort of disappeared behind the fence as the police car went through. But he could tell you many stories. And we even had a situation where we played down at Pagham once, and he decided to walk from Pagham Cricket Club down to the beach. Mm. But he didn't tell anybody. So we were sort of finishing the game and been there for an hour or so after the game, and we thought, where's Polly gone? Well, somebody must have taken him. So we all went off, and the next minute we heard was that he was still down at Pagham Cricket Ground. Mm. And he had to get a train back from Pagham back to his house. Mm-hmm. And that was the second time that had happened. And the previous occasion was down at Wisborough Green. Somebody left him behind by mistake. And bizarrely, someone from Henfield Cricket Club saw him walking along the road and they picked him up and took him home. So, you know, he's a character. Yes. In many ways. He would always find a way to get to a ground to watch his cricket. He loved it.
Right.
And just one more story. In his later life, he went to Scotland for a day to check up on Nero coffee cards. He's an avid collector of Nero coffee cards. And he went up there to get a little signature to say he'd been up there. And he went by coach, and he came back the next day to score the cricket match. He went all the way up there for one day to get a little note about Nero coffee cards. But he was somebody who you always wanted to turn up to the game. Without John, it wasn't the same.
Right.
But he was a character.
The other thing, John, he had his eccentricities, which were really sort of gentle eccentricities in the nicest possible way. But the thing I think I particularly loved about him was he loved to see people do well. He took incredible pleasure in other people performing well. So when you did have a good day on the cricket pitch, you almost felt one of the things about it was John congratulating you and enjoying the fact that you'd had a good day. And that spirit in him was very special, very special.
Yeah. I think there's a story, Malcolm, about a game at Climping when you hit a six.
Oh, a rarity that would have been. He always delighted to tell me we were batting in the league game, and I hit a six, and I bizarrely hit the clock up at Climping, and I then hit another six the next ball. And for the next 10 years, the clock had still stopped at 4:50 in the afternoon. And John always remarked, he said, "The clock hasn't been repaired yet, Malcolm." I said, "Yeah, I know, John. Don't worry about it." But it's one of those sort of things that an incident occurred, and he'd always remember it.
Yeah.
But it's things like that, or, you know, if a ball went down a rabbit hole, he'd always remind us that happened in 1724 or whatever. That's the last time somebody hit a six. Yeah. He had all these stats, all the information about the club and individuals, and it was great to listen to. Yeah.
And probably no computer either.
Oh, no.
Certainly not. He would hate a computer. He would never use it. Everything was done by beautiful handwriting. And bizarrely, you'd say to him on a Saturday, "When would so-and-so last score a 50? And just think nothing more about it. The next day on the Sunday, he had all the information. He'd stayed up at night in his house writing all the information about when that last person scored a 50. Mm. And it's just so much his life. Cricket and Linfield was his life.
Mm. It's fantastic.
Yeah,
fantastic. Now, one of the things we didn't mention when we introduced today's pod was the fact that Linfield hosted an international game. And I think in your pavilion, you've got some information on that. So I'm going to follow Malcolm over. We'll come over here to one of the boards. So tell us more about this international game, Malcolm. We're looking at a board here. It's got the World Cup 1993. And it's the Women's World Cup. New Zealand versus Holland at Linfield. So yeah. How did you get this game then?
Well, it was strange. We had a guy who knew one of the England ladies who was part of the women's cricket. And at the time, women's cricket was in its infancy. Mm. It wasn't, shall we say, as popular as it is today. And we'd undertaken a recent, about 2 years beforehand, a England versus Linfield match. And it was done very, very well. And they were very impressed. Mm. And they asked us to come back to do another game. And then they said to us, well, we could do a World Cup game here. It's a nice venue. Well, no, we didn't think much of it. And all of a sudden we said, wow, we've now got a World Cup game against Holland versus New Zealand on the Common. And we just couldn't unbelieve it. And we had over 1,000 people watching the game. It wasn't, shall we say, the most exciting of games. There's some records which still, from today, are still records in the women's cricket. I think New Holland batted first and got about 40 all out in 54 overs. So it wasn't, shall we say, the most exciting game. But the event was the most important thing.
Right.
But yeah, it was like a secretary and one of the guys who, say, knew this lady at the in women's cricket. Got the game going. But if you look at the board here, you know, there's only about 8 teams took part in that very one of the early World Cups.
Yes.
Australia, Denmark, England, Holland, Ireland, India, New Zealand, West Indies. Now, cricket has grown so much since 93, women's cricket, and it is today. This was one of the very first, and realistically, clubs of our size will never have the opportunity to to watch a game like this on Linfield Common. But it was a great event.
And there's a picture here. I don't know whether this is an England or New Zealand lady. And she's bowling in a skirt. But down here, we've got the... Is that the New Zealander there?
That's one of the New Zealand fields.
Yep. Yeah, and they're playing in trousers. So the fashion was changing at that time.
Yeah, very much. And the lady there bowling as Turner took five for five.
So it's not bad.
It's worth mentioning as well, actually, in the original game we'd had against England women in 1986, I think there were at least two of the up-and-coming England girls in that team played in the England team that actually won the World Cup in 1993, including the captain, Karen Smithies, who was a youngster in 86, but then captained England in the 93 World Cup. So that the pedigree of that team was pretty decent. The contacts that Malcolm mentioned, who the guy at our club knew, was Jan Britton, who until recently was, I think it's been surpassed now, but was the highest run scorer for England in women's cricket, and a terrific batsman. Or better, as one should say. But she, you know, that she was the connection that got us the initial game, and then
it was John Jackson, the secretary, who was heavily involved as well. So him and say Jan Britton were the relationship with us as a club to play women's cricket here.
I mean, it's a bit of a coup, really.
Absolutely.
I mean,
now you look back on it. Yeah. At the time, you didn't really think much about it. It's just a game, a cricket.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
And now, 30 years onwards, you suddenly realise how fortunate we were to have a World Cup game.
So I doubt there's any other village clubs in Sussex. Well, not in the country, probably, that have had an international game.
Probably not. When they held the World Cup here, probably 20 years before that. So I suspect they had club grounds, but I doubt it was a village ground.
No.
I think that's probably is fairly unique.
Especially not on a common.
No, absolutely not. Not on common land. You know, maybe a nice enclosed little bit of ground.
That's right.
But not common land.
What was bizarre, actually, after the game, both sides were singing. So all the New Zealand ladies were all in a little group and they were doing their songs, Māori songs and things like that. And it actually made a very special event.
Yeah.
You know, you probably wouldn't have it today.
No.
But it's at that time, it was a time and place where everything just worked perfectly. Mm.
I think going back to the low scoring, I think the story went was that the Dutch women were concerned because they were playing Denmark, who they regarded as their main rival, either the following day or a day later, and they didn't fancy being pasted round everywhere by the New Zealand batters. So that's why they batted first and then sort of
regretted it
somewhat. So that was the reasoning behind it. Yeah.
Right. But so just the scores here. We've got Holland batted first by the look of it and scored 40 off. How many overs was that?
54.2.
54.2 overs. And then New Zealand, in reply, got the required runs of
13.2
overs with only a couple of, no wickets down at all. So
bizarrely, the turner got 5 for 5. I think it's about the third best bowling figures in World Cup cricket still today.
Right. Okay,
so it's quite a rare event at the time. Yeah,
that's fantastic. That's a great treasure really to have in the pavilion here. And I'm just looking to my left, and it's not a cricket bat on the wall above the window, but it is a didgeridoo.
Very much so. Yeah.
Why is a didgeridoo in the pavilion at Linfield?
Very appropriate. We probably about 5 or 6 years before we went on a cricket tour to Australia, we had a Linfield Australia from Sydney team come and play here, to come across to tour. And we felt at the time, God, we should go out there to play. And everyone just laughed about it. And we, via Mike Newcomb, organised a cricket tour to Sydney, Australia. And we thought, we've got to bring something back to remember our event, because it probably won't happen again in our lifetime. So we brought a didgeridoo back on the aircraft, in the hold of the aircraft, as our little memory for the for future generations of the club. But it celebrated our 250th anniversary tour.
Right.
Down under.
Right. Okay.
And bizarrely, we had a 100% record. We played 7 games and lost 7 games. So it was quite an event. And we played people like Mark Rampakash out there, and some other Australians as well, international players. But it was the event. It was to do it with your mates who you'd grown up with through the juniors. Mm. That was special. We had girlfriends and wives come as well.
I think John Pollard, the scorer, Polly went, didn't he? I think it was a big trip for him.
Well, we could tell you a story too about John going across. He'd never flown before. He brought his own sandwiches on the plane because he didn't realise that they provided food on the aircraft. And about a week before we were to leave, somebody asked him about his passport, and he said, well, what do I need a passport? Well, John, you can't go across to Australia without a passport. So one of the ladies organised a passport very quickly for him, otherwise he wouldn't have gone across there. Yeah. You know, and the club were very good. They paid for him to tour with us because he didn't have the money to tour. And he loved it. It was a unique event, but it was a great time.
And that's your only overseas tour, is it?
It's probably our only tour, the occasion was great. It was sort of guys, as I said, who'd grown up through the club, and it was something we will never forget. Mm. It was great. Mike Newcomb did all the organisation through Gulliver's, but it was a great event. Mm.
Terrific. And for our listeners, if you're ever in Linfield, come into the pavilion here, and there are boards with pictures, and you can see the didgeridoo, and you can see the World Cup 93 plaque here as well. But let's just go to some of the older pictures in the museum, if we may. So starting right down at this end, because you've got it sort of numerically, haven't you, arranged?
Yeah, we started to so put just our pictures up, and we tried to sort of put it in some sort of order of year. We've through there, Mike Newcomb's family had a lot of the old pictures. So we've been to try to put them all up into some sort of framing system, where we got some names, etc. But the earliest one goes back to 1890s, and you got the famous picture of the Tates.
Yes.
Maurice Tate and his family and father, Fred and son Maurice.
I think it's like Maurice coffee, and Fred Tate, yeah.
But that was on Linfield Common. It's a famous picture.
Mm. So did they played here?
I think, yeah, they did.
Fred played here regularly in the end of the 19th century and into the start of the 20th century. I don't think Maurice ever did. I don't think Maurice Tate ever necessarily played here. But Fred certainly was a regular with the club.
Roger's got something to say here.
There's a wonderful story. Fred Tate only ever played one test match for England, 1902, and he didn't do particularly well. In fact, England lost the match narrowly, and he was blamed for the defeat. But in his sorrow, he is quoted as saying, "Never mind, I have a little lad who will make it all up for me." And that was young Maurice, who would have been about the age that he is in the photograph here. And the photograph is captioned Tate R. Tate, Fred and Maurice Tate.
And I think the really extraordinary thing, when I only saw this going through the information we've got together, was that Fred Tate was playing village cricket in 1901 for Linfield and playing, I think the Old Trafford test of 1902 against Australia in front of a crowd then of probably 15,000, I would guess. So he's literally gone from village cricket in Sussex and playing for Sussex to a test match the following year, which is unthinkable.
He'd been playing for Sussex, but still with Linfield, still actively playing village cricket.
That's amazing, isn't it? It would never happen now, would it?
No. Be a good story.
Yes, yeah, that's right. Now, I've just turned round and there's a bat in a case. I'm a bit worried because it says Surrey County Cricket Club. Oh, yes. What is this bat doing in Sussex, Malcolm?
Well, bizarrely, I shouldn't tell you this, really, but I got it from work. Yeah, it had some nice signatures on it and I thought, well, I can't just leave it in the loft. I should take it down. So I need to get a Sussex one at some point, but we've got a Surrey one. We've got an old England 11 one and some lovely old signatures on as well. Whether it's Sussex, it's not the point. It's the signatures there, which is more important.
And next to that, you've got a Sussex shirt, I think. RDF sponsorship shirt. What's that?
When I was working, there was a guy who I was working with at the time called Rakab Agger. And he was working with me, and I didn't realise at the time he played for Sussex. Mm. And I said, God, have you got an old shirt you can give us to put in the pavilion? And he gave me the shirt from when he was playing with Sussex. And then after that, we had another guy who played for the club called Abby Sagandi.
Yes.
And we got his shirt as well.
Right.
So we tried to add, not just photographs, we tried to add a little bit more to the environment of the lounge area to soften. So we got shirts, pictures, didgeridoos and so on. So, and we got shirts as well.
And Abby's an example of someone who actually came through our junior teams and also was playing sort of fourth and third 11 cricket when he was probably about 13. And then, you know, shortly after that, Oxford University in Sussex. So he's someone who's really gone through the whole club system in that respect.
And what was interesting about Abby was that there's a guy called Mark Lawrence, who was the secretary stroke chairman of the club. He was at Ardenai College at the time. His son was there as well. And Abby hadn't played cricket before. And Mark and his son, Geoffrey, got him to play cricket. And it was from that an early stage that he started to play cricket. And he joined Linfield. Mm. And obviously, he went to Sussex and obviously to Leicester afterwards. Mm. So it just shows that, you know, even at a later age, as Abby was, he was so talented, he could play county cricket. Mm. So we're very honoured and very pleased to have Abby as being part of Linfield. As a club, so yeah.
You'll have to come down to the museum and we can sort you out with some more bats and shirts,
yeah,
because we've got too many at the moment.
Many, okay.
So now I'm just looking around the rest of the pavilion here. We've got a wonderful framed aerial view of the cricket ground and Linfield showing the high street, which is absolutely beautiful. And on the left here, we've got a shirt. Now, I'm interested in the swan symbol on your shirt because I come to Linfield regularly. I only ever see ducks on the pond. So why have you got swans?
Well, it's a long story, but swans have always been on the pond. And probably in the 70s, there was a swan called Charles and Diana, which were damaged or they couldn't fly away. And then one got, I think, killed. And the other one was a bit sad. Mm. So they took it off and they said, or decided at the end of the day, was that they weren't going to replace the swans because what was happening, the swans were killing the ducks. So they decided that if a swan wanted to come here by its own way, nature, they would leave the swan there. But they weren't going to bring the swans in and clip its wings so it couldn't fly away. Mm. So unfortunately, for the last 30-odd years, there's been no swans on the pond. But we've still got the swan as our emblem because, as far as we're concerned, that is Linfield.
Yes.
The football club have it as well. So, but unfortunately, there's no swans. But there's lots of ducks.
Lots of ducks, that's right.
And Canada geese.
We've got one other board which I'd just like to cover, and that's got a game. It's advertising Linfield CC versus MCC in July 1949. So can you tell us anything about this game, guys? I mean, do you play MCC regularly, or what's the situation?
We play MCC every odd year. So in between years, we have a President's 11 game, but in the odd years, we play the MCC, and we're very grateful that they still come down. I think I'm right in saying that the connection was from our former president and chairman, Graham Dunbar, who was an MCC member and revitalised the club really after the Second World War. And I think the link came with Graham. And it's been great that they have continued to maintain that with us. And we always make a day of it. It's usually a pretty decent game of cricket as well, actually, and they bring down, they judge the strength of the team to bring down pretty well, which is not easy. And it's always been an occasion, and we're fortunate that the club of their eminence still keeps up the fixture.
Mm. But it's part of our cricket week. We're one of the few clubs. Henfield used to have a cricket week. They only play probably a couple of games now. Right. Cookfield have a cricket week the same week as us, the first week in August. And that tradition has continued for many, many years. And we've done it over 50-odd years now. And it's a great tradition. Mm. It's cricket, how we used to know cricket, how it used to be played in a friendly spirit, but competitive spirit. Mm. Things have changed slightly over the years. But it's a tradition which we all love. Mm. So yeah.
And are you playing MCC this year?
No, it's the President's Game this year, and it's MCC in 2025. Yeah.
Right, okay. Yeah. Right. Okay, that's lovely. Well, it's been great talking to you guys. Just before we finish, Johnny Barclay taught me this one the last time we did a podcast. Sussex is famed for having a beautiful coast, and it's also got the South Downs. And Johnny asked the question of our last guest, are you a coastal man or are you a downsman? Colin?
I'm a downsman.
Any particular reason why you're a downsman? You're miles from the coast here.
Well, I think there is actually. I was actually born in Bournemouth, where there was lovely sandy beaches. And when I was first taken to the beach at Brighton, I was like, you cannot be serious. I thought, pebbles, you're joking. So, no, I'm a downsman.
Right, downsman.
I agree with Colin. I'm a downsman as well. I think when you go on top of Ditchling Beacon and you look across there, the scenery is just beautiful. And you can still see the beach from the beacon and you can see the Amex football ground, but the overall view from the Downs is fantastic. And as far as I'm concerned, that is Sussex, the Downs. It's beautiful.
Yeah. That's right. Now, Roger, I don't think you're not originally from Sussex. Oh, you are, Roger. You're not there now, though, are you? Not. are you a coastal man or are you a downsman?
No, I was born and bred in Hurstpier Point.
Pretty much Sussex.
Yeah, under the shadow of Worstonbury, which is part of the South Downs.
Lovely.
And some of my earliest memories are climbing up Worstonbury, and I love those South Downs, and I have walked the South Downs way.
Very good, Roger. And you don't like the pebbles on the beach either, I imagine.
No, nice fish and chips, but not.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. No, I'm much happier inland. Keith. Yeah, lovely. Thank you.
Okay, well, that's been great. Thanks very much to Colin, to Malcolm, and to Roger. And if you like our podcasts, please, on whatever channel you listen to them, please favourite them and they'll drop straight into your inbox when we record another one. But for now, from Linfield with the sun setting, it's goodbye. Cheerio.